Back chat.
Politics and current affairs.
Back chat.
Your alternative to talk back.
Hello, it is Saturday, December 9th, and you are listening to Backchat, where we bring you the stories of Sydney and beyond. We're broadcasting from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to elders past and present. Redfern's always been a place for storytelling, and we're honoured to be able to continue in that tradition. My name's Holly Payne. I'm joined by the effervescent Beck Cushway. Beck, hello.
Hello, effervescent. I like that.
Now, Beck, what's coming up?
Well, it's getting hot in here. 2023 has just been confirmed as the hottest year on record. And with a whole El Nino summer stretching out before us, it's a fair bet that beaches will be packed out these holidays. But how much do you actually know about staying safe in the water? Stay tuned, because we'll be chatting to a man who calls himself Dr. Rip later on in the show.
And before that, I'm sure you've heard about the Rozelle Interchange. That's the spaghetti junction that's been causing major traffic chaos with confusing signs and a major bottleneck. There's a lot to unpack here, and we'll be breaking down what happened and why, so stay tuned.
And of course, if any of that pricked your ears, then get in touch. What's your experience been like on the Rozelle Interchange? We want to know. And if you're going to the beach today, text us on 0409 945 945 or DM us on Instagram at BackchatFBI.
Backchat Backtalk. Try it, ain't no
backtalk. Driving in Sydney in peak hour is already pretty chaotic, but these last few weeks it's been even worse for those who use the new Rozelle Interchange. What was meant to be a 20-minute journey took over an hour for drivers on the first day the Rozelle Interchange opened. Talk about traffic chaos.
I would rather not. In just 2 weeks, the Rozelle Interchange has already undergone some design changes and made a local community very angry. There's been a lot of news about the interchange. And to break it all down for you, we're joined by Backchat producer Sana Sheikh. Sana, there's been a lot of discussion. What's the background? Give us the scoop.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. Recently, the long-awaited Rozelle Interchange was opened a few weeks ago. It's part of West Connects, and it connects the inner west to the city. It's an underground motorway that connects the Iron Cove Bridge and the Anzac Bridge and the M4-M5 link. This multi-billion dollar project has been marred by issues since before the interchange even began, even opened. But let's focus on what's happened since the public first got to drive on the interchange. On the very, very, very first day, drivers were confused by the road signs on the spaghetti junction, and traffic during that Monday morning peak hour rush stood still. Unheard of in Sydney, right? It was pretty bad that even the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns said the signs were not good enough. One of the issues were that drivers were merging on the different roads because they didn't know which parts of the tunnel were toll-free because of the signs. This meant that some people had an extra hour added to their journey due to these issues, but, you know, credit needs to be given to the New South Wales government, who changed those signs that first day.
Have you had any issues with confusing road signs and it's messed up your journey?
We were talking about this earlier. I'm on my P's, so I always struggle with road signs because it's just too much information for me to, like, scan the road but also figure out where I need to turn and then be in the correct lane. The other day, I drove the wrong direction on a one-way, but that's okay because cute girls are allowed to break road rules.
It's actually a little known
aspect of the law. Yeah.
Look, yeah. I avoided that section, like the where the Rozelle Interchange is, before it opened. So I'm going to continue to avoid it now. And look, is that all that's been happening recently with the Rozelle Interchange?
Oh, no. There is a lot more. Since the Rozelle Interchange opened, it's clear that there are bottlenecks or pinch points, as the New South Wales government are calling them, at parts of the interchange, which is pretty much caused by multiple lanes merging into one lane. For example, there's a pinch point near the Anzac Bridge. Residents and drivers are not very happy about this, understandably so.
The whole thing's an unmitigated disaster. We've got cars going the wrong way up the street, people being told there's tolls when there's no tolls, and now they're on Victoria Road, they've reduced three lanes down to one lane so that everyone gets fed into the tunnel. It's a joke.
So, Sana, how did the government respond to this?
Well, the government did respond pretty quickly to these issues, and I've got to give them credit for it. Last week, they said that they will add an extra lane to the City West Link to address these pinch points. That extra lane was set to be 400 metres long near the City West Link, and it merges with the Crescent overpass before the Anzac Bridge.
Oh, Sana, have we still got you? Oh, dear. Well, luckily, we have another resident who was happy to speak to us about her experience.
In the 18 months they were building the Roselle Interchange, we were looking for information. Which tunnels lead where? Which roads do we take to get to go to the city or to go back over to the Gladesville Bridge? It was so confusing. And now, as we know, it's open and it's just chaos. What a disaster.
Beck, look, how did the council respond?
So on Thursday, the Inner West Council held a town hall with residents about these issues to hear what they had to say. The meeting was pretty fiery and residents expressed their anger at what's been happening. We've got to remember that these people have spent years dealing with road closures while the interchange was being built. And what was interesting is that Guardian Australia reported that a senior executive from Transport for New South Wales, Howard Collins, was at the meeting and answered the residents' questions. It seemed like he copped a lot of flack from them. Anyway, Mr. Collins held the Guardian that the traffic snares would be eased over time, but investment in public transport was a long-term solution and he wanted to help inner west locals in the meantime. Have I mentioned that the WestConnex cost more than $20 billion to make when it was originally thought to only cost $10 billion? The Mayor of Inner West Council, Darcy Byrne, told the media that the town hall with the residents was important for Transport New South Wales to have to understand just how angry the local community is.
Look, it's clear that the government is kind of putting out spot fires with issues when the Roselle interchange kind of came up, and they've been doing it pretty quickly, but it is expected that 100,000 vehicles will drive on the interchange every day. 40 degrees in the city today, 44 in Western Sydney. So, look, I'm no scientist, but it's clear that the climate crisis is happening now and we're seeing more record-breaking hot days than ever before. With around 36 million vehicles expected to go through the Roselle interchange every year, there needs to be a lot of fossil fuels powering that. So, you know, whether the next stage should be and what that should look like, Howard Collins from Transport for New South Wales said it best, investment in public transport infrastructure for all and not spending billions of taxpayer dollars on roads so we tackle the climate crisis and traffic congestion issues in Greater Sydney together. Head on. Next up, we'll be chatting to coastal geomorphologist Professor Robert Brander, aka Dr. Rip, about beach safety. We promise it'll be super interesting.
You're tuned into Backchat on FBI 94.5.
Yesterday was not my birthday, so you are wrong. My birthday was last month.
Backchat on FBI Radio.
Today is hot, hot, hot. It is week two of summer, and we're already cracking 40 degrees. Chances are you'll be looking ahead to the beach for a cool and refreshing swim.
We're here to remind you that the ocean hides many dangers, both seen and unseen, and you should be scared. Well, it's critters like sharks that get the lion's share of attention when we're talking about ocean dangers. The real killer, the one responsible for 21 deaths in Australia each year, is much more mundane.
We're talking about rip currents, and we're joined by UNI South Wales Beach Safety Research Professor Rob Brander, the man who calls himself Dr. Rip. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks for having me. And I don't call myself Dr. Rip. Other people call me Dr. Rip.
It is very uncool to give yourself a nickname, so understandable.
Yeah.
Look, Rob, as we were saying, when most people think of dangers at the beach, you think of wildlife, sharks, jellyfish, stonefish. That's not necessarily where the biggest dangers lie. Rob,
no,
what is
not
a rip?
At all. Yeah, so rips, it's actually that number of fatalities caused by rips every year on average is now 26 per year. A rip current is a really common feature on any beach that's got breaking waves, so any kind of surf beach, and it's just like a river of the sea. And just like rivers, most rips sit in deep channels between shallow sandbars. They're pretty narrow, and they take all the water, not all the water, but a lot of the water coming in with the breaking waves back offshore. So they flow faster than most people can swim. And there's an estimated 17,000 of them on our beaches at any given time.
I've always avoided the white, foamy areas of surf, thinking that was the rip, and gone for the smooth green bit because it looked calmer. After reading a bit of your work, I realized that was the opposite of what I should be doing. Tell us about how to spot a rip current from the shore.
Yeah, a lot of people avoid whitewater breaking waves because it looks nasty and dangerous and messy. But the best way to spot a rip current is to get a bit of elevation. So you could be on top of a headland, on top of a sand dune, but a little bit of elevation helps. Having polarized sunnies helps. And what you do is you look up and down the beach for a couple of minutes, and what you're looking for are these narrow, dark green gaps between the white water. Because the white water is where it's shallow, the waves are breaking, whereas these green, narrow gaps are deeper channels. Deeper water is always darker. You don't get as much waves breaking in the deep channels. So you're looking for those narrow green gaps, almost like paths going out through the white water. That's the main thing to look for. But rip currents, because the rips are taking water offshore and the waves are bringing it back onshore, you got this water coming together, and that makes the surface of the rip look a bit bumpy and turbulent compared to the surrounding areas. So those are the two main ways. These rips, not all rips sit in channels, but the ones that do can be there for days or weeks, and they carve out these embayments along the beach. So if you look along the beach and you see this big carved out scallop, and then you see this dark line heading out in front of it, that's another way to spot them.
Why do polarized sunnies help?
I think they just cut through the glare. So they cut through the glare so you don't see the reflection off the surface of the water, but you can really see the contrast between the white water and the green gaps, and you can see all the sandbars and stuff. I don't know the physics behind polarized lenses, but it helps.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI, and we are currently chatting to beach safety expert, Professor Rob Brander. We're talking about secret open ocean dangers. Now, you've gone into some rips willingly, Rob. What does one do when caught in a rip?
Yeah, I mean, surfers use rips all the time. It helps them get out the back, and I use them to go body surfing and stuff. But, you know, most people who get caught in rips aren't necessarily familiar with them, and they're at risk. So, you know, most people say, what does it feel like to be stuck in a rip? It doesn't feel like anything, because you're just going with the flow. It's like a ride. It's only when you notice the beach disappearing that you think, oh, what's going on? And most people's reaction is to swim back to the beach against the rip, which is not what you want to do, because these things flow incredibly fast, faster than you could swim. You're just going to tire yourself out and panic. So the best thing to do if you find yourself caught in a rip is always just to float, because floating means you're conserving your energy, and you can signal for help. That's so important. And if there's lifeguards or lifesavers on the beach, you know, you raise your arm, you wave it, they should see you. But remember, there's also lots of surfers in the water, and we've done lots of studies, and surfers do a ton of rescues. So floating's always the best. Just remember to relax and float, because rips, they're just taking you for a ride. They're not pulling you under the water. They're not taking you to New Zealand. So that floating's always best.
Yeah, I read a really interesting account that you wrote, I think, in The Guardian about being in a huge rip in New Zealand for science, see how far out it would take you.
Yeah, we jumped in these rips on purpose. And we had people with survey instruments on the dunes measuring our pathway out. And this rip in New Zealand at Mirawai Beach near Auckland took us about 300, 400 meters offshore. We had a boat waiting, like one of those IRBs waiting for us. But it was massive, huge. And when you're that far offshore, you can't see the beach. Like, you can't even see. All you see is walls of water now. We don't have rips like that around here, but which is a good thing.
Yeah, how do you stay calm in that situation?
Well, you don't. I mean, yeah. You know, the only reason I was calm was because I knew there was a boat waiting for me. But it's easy to say float and stay calm, but it is hard, right? But the thing is, you need to think it's just taking me for a ride. And the key thing is, if there's people around, signal for help, you'll be okay.
What about when you see someone else caught in a rip?
Yeah, that's a big deal. These are called bystander rescues. So a member of the public sees somebody caught in a rip, it might be their child, and they go in to help them, and they often tragically drown. And last year, I think we had 5 fathers drowning, trying to save their children, which is terrible. So I guess the rule is, if you see somebody in trouble, even if it's your child, of course you're going to want to go in, but just don't rush in. Take 10 seconds, call for help, or get somebody else to call for help. Maybe there's this thing called an emergency response beacon on the beach, but get somebody to get help. And then also look around. Maybe there's something on the beach. If, you know, like maybe somebody has a boogie board or a surfboard or an esky, something that floats. Because if you're going to go in, you have to take something that floats with you. But you don't want to rush in, because if you sprint to the beach, you know, you're already tired, you swim as fast as you can, you get to that person, you're exhausted, they're probably okay because they're just floating, not knowing what's going on. So don't rush in. Call for help. Bring some of the floats.
We had a text in about this saying that was a great bit of info from your guest. I was at Whale Beach with my daughter last Sunday night and we were trying to pick the rips, but it was getting dark. We decided it was safer to go for a walk along the sand instead. That was Bernie in Bondi. What about if you're on a beach where somewhere that there's no lifeguards, no sort of rescue support? What's the best thing to do in that scenario?
Yeah, we call those beaches unpatrolled beaches, and that's the big problem because last summer there was 54 people who drowned along our coast, and every single one of them was at an unpatrolled location. So the thing there is, if in doubt, don't go out. I mean, if you don't know how to spot rips, if you're not a good swimmer, you should not be going in past your waist, and always make sure your feet are firmly on the sand. So we've got this campaign from Surf Life Saving Australia called the Think Line, which is this concept that anytime you go to the beach, you need to stop and spend a few minutes thinking about beach safety. Are there any rips around? Do you know what rips are? Are the waves too big? And have a plan if something goes wrong. Like if somebody were to get in trouble, what would you do? Because if you're swimming at an unpatrolled beach by yourself and you're not a good swimmer, you should not have gone in the water.
Look, are there any kind of general beach safety tips you can give us?
Yeah, well, I think that's a big one. I think the think line or this concept of thinking about beach safety is huge because we rely so much on swimming between the flags. But you know, there's a limited amount of beaches that have flags. Once you get outside the main populated areas, there's not many, you know, they're mostly unpatrolled. So we need, just like you wouldn't cross a road without looking both ways, you should always spend a few minutes thinking about beach safety. I guess the other thing, getting back to rips, because rips are the big deal. You know, the ones I described are these ones that sit in the deep channel. So they look like these dark gaps and they can be there for days and weeks. But there's other types of rips. We get these rip currents that flow out against structures like headlands and rocks and rock outcrops and piers and jetties and groins. And these rips, they're called boundary rips. You know, the water flows along the beach and they just get deflected off. And they can be there almost all the time. So these boundary rips are really dangerous. And that's why you should never really swim next to structures and headlands and rocks. Just stay well away. So they're common because we have lots of headlands. And then there's another rip, which is the tricky one, which I try and avoid talking about because it's tricky, but they're called flash rips. And all it takes is, like, rip currents are all about breaking waves. So if the waves are breaking and you got sandbars and stuff, you're going to get rip currents. But these flash rips, they don't sit in channels. If there's a couple of big waves that break, the water level rises up a little bit and boosh, this water just flows offshore. And it might last for a minute, maybe 2 minutes. It's a rip, and then it disappears. And then some big waves, you know, form further down the beach, and boom, you get another flash rip, and then it disappears. So these flash rips are flashing all up and down the beach, and they look like clouds of sand. So suspended clouds of sand, the turbulent, streaky water, and they're really tricky because they're hard to predict. They happen quickly, and they're difficult to spot, especially when you're in the water. But they happen on days that are kind of messy, when the waves are pretty messy and chopped up. So, yeah, that's just something to be aware of. I guess the other thing is about rip currents is that rip currents flow faster, about maybe every 1.5 hours either side of low tide, because it's shallow, waves are breaking more. That's what's driving your rip. So it pays, you know, it's worthwhile making sure you know what the tide's doing when you go to the beach. And, you know, often lifeguards put up the tide times on the charts. But, you know, basically if there's rips and you're 1.5 hours either side of low tide, they're going to be pumping.
That was so many fun facts. I'm going to go home and scare my family.
Yeah, well, you don't want to scare people, but we've done lots of studies where we've done surveys of people who've been caught in rip currents before, and we've interviewed people. So we did about 70 interviews with people, and these are traumatic experiences. I mean, you hear about the fatalities, but there's people who have never stepped foot in the ocean again after being stuck in a rip. And yeah, it's a highly emotional topic, and they don't really get the attention they deserve, because, you know, you might get one person drown, or you might get a week later another person drown, but over time the amount of people drowning in rips is more than are killed by bushfires, cyclones, floods and sharks combined in the long term.
Yeah, I think deal. There's something there about, you know, everyone wants to hear about sharks, about jellyfish, about these kind of visible dangers, but, you know, rips do get overlooked.
Yeah, and just not just rips, like another, you know, you got to watch out for what we call dumping waves. So, you know, maybe people have heard of a shore dump. You know, you go to the beach and kaboom, there's this big wave breaking on the beach. It's like this explosion. And there's a lot of spinal injuries and there's a lot of shoulder injuries from people just getting slammed, just getting knocked over. So if you go to a beach and there's a really heavy wave break at the shoreline, that's what we call a shore dump. And you got to be super careful getting in and you got to be super careful getting out. And if you're getting in and you see this big wave about to crash in your head, you need to get under. You need to dive, well, not dive, but just get under and get flat underneath the wave, like hugging the bottom literally. And that's a lot safer. And then when you come back in, you never turn your back on the wave, right? You get your timing right. So we get a lot of those things. The other thing with blue bottles or jellyfish you mentioned, at least where we are in New South Wales, the only jellyfish that's an issue are blue bottles. The little, you know, they got the little purple, bluey thing floating on the surface. And then they got the tentacles hanging down. Those can be pretty nasty. So they're not going to kill you, but you're going to get a nasty sting that's going to happen for a few hours, maybe a bit longer. So if you do get stung by a blue bottle, there's a bunch of bad advice out there. The best thing to do, in fact, the only thing you should do is get the tentacles off first, right? And if it's a kid, get the parent to get the tentacles off because they're still zapping you when they're wrapped around. But then you treat it with water as hot as you can stand.
Don't pee on it.
Well, you could. I mean, people say that. And you think, but there's you know, there's truth to it, but I wouldn't recommend it in public.
Anyway. Rob, thank you so much. This has been really informative.
No, it's
big
good.
Thanks to our guest, Professor Rob Branda. And if you want some more info on rips and beach safety, you can pick up his book, Dr. Rip's Essential Beach Book. Big thanks to our producer, Sana Sheikh, and of course, Holly Payne.
And this is our last show on air for 2023, but you can keep up with Backchat on socials at BackchatFBI or listen back to the podcast anytime.
Backchat is produced by FBI Radio in Sydney. Tune in live every Saturday at 9:30 a.m. Find more at fbiradio.com/backchat.